You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
I'm Hillary Kerr, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I have two fabulous women in the studio with me, Sarah and Erin Foster. Maybe you know them from their hysterical reality parody show, Barely Famous, which they co-created, executive produced, and starred in. Or maybe you know them from their work at Bumble, where they are the heads of creative. Or maybe you follow them on Instagram and adore their content like I do. But before they were barely famous and actually, like, truly famous, they both struggled with their career paths and have been very candid about the journey to creating fulfilling work for themselves. I can't wait for them to tell you all about it. Now, on Second Life, it's Sarah and Erin Foster. Let's start at the beginning with the same question that I ask everyone who comes on this podcast. What did you study in school, and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up? Why don't we start with you, Erin?
I did not go to college, so I didn't study anything. I did very poorly in school. I failed out of the 10th grade and had to make it up in summer school.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And then I left and went to boarding school in Switzerland to try to reinvent myself.
How'd that go?
It was great. It was everything I needed it to be. And I thought I was going to be an actress. I didn't think that I would be able to pull off being a writer.
That's awesome. Okay, so Sarah, what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
So I was the child that wore a pen around my neck. I wore Stanford sweatshirts. I asked for filing cabinets for my birthday when I was 7. I would subscribe to National Geographic did this thing where they sent animal cards. Instead of playing with my friends outside, I would file them because I enjoyed filing.
This was very young, like 7 or 8.
Yeah, this was very young. Cut to age 16, where people told me I was cute, and I was like, oh, I should be a model or something like this, which is embarrassing to admit. But my focus really shifted in a way that is probably my biggest regret. I went straight from high school to Paris to try to model. And
what was that like?
You know, it really wasn't a dream to be a model. That was never even anything I ever even thought of. But when you find yourself in this position where people are telling you, oh my gosh, you're pretty and you're tall and you could make so much money and you could have independence, and all I ever wanted was independence, I always wanted to be an adult. And now that I'm an adult, I'm like, oh God, I was—
Let me go back.
I was in such a hurry. But my biggest regret is not going to college. Yes, straight from high school, I was working and I was making money and it was great. But I wasn't, like, in my body. It didn't feel authentic, really, to me. I wasn't a good model. It didn't make me happy. But, you know, I paid the bills.
So is that why you decided to transition into acting? And what was the spark for making that shift?
So through modeling, I got an opportunity to be in a music video.
Which music video?
Backstreet Boys.
Shape
of my heart. And I got a call. They were like, they would love to see you for this. And of course, I was so excited. Backstreet Boys was like the biggest thing at the time. And I thought I was just going in for a regular audition, which is, you know, when you're modeling, they don't care what your voice sounds like. It's like, okay, show us your profile. How tall are you? Blah, blah, blah. I went in and it was Matthew Ralston was the director. He was a very big director at the time. And there was another woman in there. And I wasn't quite sure who she was. Long story short, she was an acting coach, Lee Kilton Smith, who was like Jen Aniston's acting coach on Friends. And she was a very popular acting coach. And I was confused why she was there. And they said, okay, we want you to act out this scene. And they gave me the gist of it. And in the moment, I was like, this is amazing. I love it. I started crying. I was so in the moment. And she was like, you're not an actress? I can't believe you're not an actress. I didn't even think I had it in me. I got the job. And it just sort of ignited in something in me. It didn't even occur to me that it could maybe be a profession or that I could take it any further. But that was sort of like the first opportunity I had to be more than a model.
Got it. And then you had a really big break with The Big Bounce. Did you feel equipped for that? Did you feel like you had studied? Did you feel – had you taken classes? Did you have any training or were you just winging it? Did you know what a mark was? Like, I feel like there are a lot of things.
Right. So I worked with Lee. We sort of – we became friends and she believed in me. And I had worked with her a little bit, but I wasn't like telling people, you guys, I want to be an actress. Like, I was so stuck in trying to be cool when I was young. I could never admit – this thing that I might want to try because I might fail. But no, The Big Bounce, I was not equipped. I mean, I auditioned like any other person and I got the job, which was crazy. I kept thinking like, I don't deserve to be here. And then like, wait, yes, I do. I did. I do. I auditioned. I chemistry read with Owen Wilson. Like this, I do deserve to be here. But then that other side of me was like, no, you do not deserve to be here. And the truth is, to star in a movie with Morgan Freeman and Owen Wilson and all these people, your first job? Come on. I mean, and it was the female lead? No, I didn't deserve to be there.
Well, I don't think there's a – it's not about deserving, but you maybe you felt like you hadn't put in as much of the pavement pounding.
I had not pounded the pavement enough. I had not really paid my dues. And I found out quickly that – if you want to be a good actor, you need to study. I think some of our best actors today are – they're trained. Natalie Portman, trained. Charlize Theron, trained. Jessica Chastain, trained. These are trained actors, and they're the ones we respect the most. And you can wing it for so long, but you get kicked back. And I got kicked back. I thought I was going to be the next Cameron Diaz. I was sure of it because that's what people were telling me.
Got it. Okay. So then you kept working, though. Mm-hmm. You kept getting jobs.
Well, so you know what happens when you're starring in a movie and it hasn't come out yet? There's hype, right? Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of hype. Like, who's this girl? And I started getting offered roles without anyone seeing what I could actually do. And my agents were like, we really got to get her a job because I think in the back of their mind, they knew, like, she's probably not going to be very good in the movie.
But strike while the iron's hot, and if you have opportunities, take them.
Exactly. You have to. So I got offered a couple movies that I actually passed on, which I didn't know. I didn't know the business. I knew nothing. I just followed what people were telling me. I ended up – my follow-up movie to The Big Bounce was a movie called Debs, which actually became, like, a cult following.
It's a total cult classic.
It's a total cult classic. And – that one I felt more deserving of. That one I sort of felt like I belong here.
And then eventually –
and by that time I knew what a mark was.
So you were starting to get your awareness.
Yes.
And then eventually, at some point, you got 90210.
There was a long period in there. There was a period I was like playing a corpse in Crossing Jordan where I was literally in a body bag with no lines.
Paying your dues.
Yeah, no, but that's what happens. You pay your dues at some point, right? It happens either in the beginning, the middle, or the end. But at some point, you're going to get kicked back to have to pay those dues. And it happened to me. Casting directors started saying, yeah, she came in, she was good, but – you know, the other girls were better. And that kind of kept happening. Mm-hmm. One thing they would say is, she was so great in the meeting, which I can kill at a meeting. But then when it came to the audition, it just wasn't as strong as the meeting. And it starts wearing on you. You really start becoming insecure. And I had to make a decision. It was like, yo, I need to actually go and learn what the fuck I'm doing. Because this is just embarrassing now. You know, it's embarrassing when people think you're going to become something and then you don't. You disappoint this team around, you know, CAA had signed me. And I think CAA was kind of going like, okay, like, what's happening? This is not what we thought was.
So did you go to school for it or take classes?
So
or...
Things changed for me when I went to this comedy intensive. Leslie Kahn is an acting teacher here in LA who's really amazing. And I did a 4-week comedy intensive. Mm-hmm. And she really gave me the security that I really needed. She pulled me aside and she was like, you're really good. You're really funny. You're the best in this class. And even if it wasn't true, her saying that, it just sort of changed everything for me. And after that comedy intensive, I got a couple other movies and I got 90210. And when 90210 came to me, it was just supposed to be for a couple episodes to play the evil mean sister. But I was grateful for it. You know, it's an interesting thing when you really feel yourself and you really think you're too good for things, and then to sort of get kicked back into place, you find gratitude, which I had to find, and I was just so grateful to have that job. And then it turned into me being on the show for like 4 years.
Well, it's interesting too, because we've had a lot of people who are actors and work in the industry mm-hmm. on the pod. And one thing that I think really prepares you for the future is the level of rejection you get in this industry, because it's just constant. And then it starts to get to a point where it doesn't weigh on you as much. Where you don't necessarily take it so personally always, but having had some of that, you know, sort of like rougher feedback in the beginning and persevering through it ends up being really powerful and useful.
Oh, I'm shocked that I didn't quit. I mean, I did a pilot, a UPM pilot, and we shot the pilot and everybody was getting called because they needed their flights booked for upfronts, and my phone wasn't ringing. I was like, what is happening? I got fired from the pilot. I mean, I have had from modeling, people telling me, like, by me hearing them behind the camera, like, oh, she's not that pretty. She's not as photogenic. She was prettier here. She doesn't look as bright. Like, they talk. They say this to where you can hear them. I've had so much rejection. And
I think the important thing about the rejection in acting and modeling and the entertainment business is that if you want the payoff, which is very big, it's fame, it's stardom, it's a lot of money, it's big success. If you want that payoff, you have to be willing to hear the rejection and you have to be willing to self-correct. So if you're going to 15 auditions and you're not getting the job, you have to be willing to call your managers or agents and say, what are they saying I'm doing wrong? And if they're saying you're unprepared, you don't know how to cry on cue, you don't look good when you come in the audition, I think we need to change your hair color, you need to go back to acting class, you don't know how to hit a comedic joke, like whatever the thing is, there's a reason. If you're not working, there's probably a reason. There's probably a consistent thing that's being told to someone.
It all comes down to the work, but you have to
be willing to hear the truth. They're saying you're difficult. They're saying you're not prepared. You showed up late. You didn't deliver on set. Like, you have to really take a look at what you're doing that's creating the rejection.
It's so interesting. In my 20s, I didn't want to hear any of that. I was like a wounded little bird. I want nothing to do with that. And then in my 30s, I was like, I want to know every detail. Tell me everything.
That's why you can't grow unless you're willing. You can't, rejection's not always. If everyone has an issue with you or if everyone's not hiring you, the only thing in common is you. So you need to be aware of what you're not delivering in the room and be willing to hear it and like make a choice. Do you want to correct that thing or do you want to hide and bury your head in the sand and just say this business is hard?
I remember in an audition with Deb Aquila. She's like the biggest casting director. And I finished an audition and we both knew that it didn't go well. It was for, oh God, I think I was playing a stewardess or something. I don't remember. And I finished and she really liked me. She wanted to give me the job. I know it. And we finish and I sort of looked at her and she looked at me and I go, oh, just say it. And she goes, I just didn't believe you. I just didn't believe you. And I was like, oh God. And then she had actually followed me out. She was like, look, you have it. You have it. You got to study. You got to study. And she gave me the name of this guy, Ron Burris, and I did an intensive with him. And it all comes back to the work. It just does. There are very few people. Like Charlize Theron is an anomaly that she just got discovered in a McDonald's. I mean, granted, she had tons of training with her dance and her ballet, which I think is a real – it might not be – theater, but it's a form of training and discipline. But that is rare. It's just rare to just be discovered in a McDonald's where you haven't even thought about being an actress and you get an Oscar.
Totally.
Like, who else does that happen for?
Not very many people.
No, you got to do the work. It's that simple. My daughter says she wants to be an actress. Great. Go to Juilliard.
That is excellent advice.
Yeah.
So, Erin, Let's get back to you.
I'm here too, guys.
Yeah. So you started off as an actress as well.
Mm-hmm.
How did that go? And what did you love about it? And what was rough?
Well,
And why acting?
I always, as a kid, was like in school plays and always thought I wanted to be an actress. And I always had ideas for writing. And I wrote poetry when I was a kid. And like, I would do certain writing, but it was a lot of creative writing, and it wasn't something that I thought I could actually parlay into a career. And I always was into film and TV, so I thought being an actress was the way to do it. The truth is, as an actress, I just was reading this book last night about David Lynch. He talked about how once he started doing film after being a painter, it was all green lights for him. That's just how his path was. And for me, my path to being an actress was all red lights. I was not getting doors open. Nobody was saying to me in an acting class, you're the best one in the room, or like, I'm so inspired by your scene. I wasn't getting the kind of traction that I wanted. In my mind, I was going to be doing these like really indie, complicated, dark films that would be at Sundance.
Like Michelle Williams.
Exactly. And instead, I was auditioning for soap operas and shitty teen shows and still not even getting those jobs. And so the jobs I was getting were really unfulfilling. It was one episode of a handful of great shows, like a House or a CSI. And I was always playing these like dark, edgy drug addicts or like just complicated, dark characters. But the truth is, I just didn't really know who I was, and I didn't really know who I wanted to be. And I kept trying to not be this blonde actress in LA. I wanted to be complicated and dark and edgy. And it was just not authentic. And so when I was about 27, I was really sick of banging my head against a wall and trying the acting thing because it was really unfulfilling and I really wasn't doing a great job at it. I wasn't making a living at it. I always had to have day jobs. So I then realized I kind of want to be a writer. And I started this blog called totallyconfidentandcompletelyinsecure.com. And when it comes to writing, it was all green lights for me.
Interesting.
Acting was all red lights and writing was all green lights. I started a blog and then everybody loves the blog. And then I got hired Hello Giggles to write this. I wrote a single girl's guide, and then the single girl's guide is the most popular one. And then I start doing these like video blogs on YouTube from Hello Giggles, and then it's getting like 30,000 views, which is, you know, this is 10 years ago, and that's like I should have stuck with it, by the way. Who knew that being like a YouTube star was going to be a super lucrative thing?
Those videos were amazing.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I would have a guest, and we'd just talk about dating, and we'd talk about what happened to me that week in life, and I don't know why the hell people cared about it. But when I tapped into my voice and not reading someone else's material as an actress, that's where I hit all green lights. And I started really feeling like myself, like, oh, I have something to say and I contribute and people like it. And I realized that the quality that people really liked in the writing that I was doing was relatability. That was my access point. And it's important for everyone to find what their access point is. What is your message? What's your perspective? Because everyone's living in the same place. What is your unique perspective that other people can relate to? And that was the thing that I tapped into. And once I felt that hit, that like people want you, they want to hire you, they want to pay you for this thing, I never missed acting. Why would I want to fail at something when I can succeed at something?
And by the way, you were working at Free People as you were finding your voice as a writer, too.
Yeah,
which so, we talked about this when we did a panel, the three of us together. I moderated barely recently. And I thought it was so amazing because you talked about the fact that like you used to work at Free People and that you had that moment where you're like, okay, this is what I need to do to pay my cell phone bill while I'm going after the things that I'm really interested in.
Yes. I think it's important for everyone, especially when you're chasing a dream that is elitist. It's elitist to think you're entitled to be a successful writer, actress in Hollywood, that you're entitled to this kind of life. And I really needed money. I really didn't want to keep asking my parents to help me. And I was ashamed of it. I mean, we obviously come from a background of privilege. We weren't struggling. We could ask for money if we wanted our parents to help us. And when I was 26, 27 years old, I was, for a long time, I lived in this apartment in Hollywood. It was pretty nasty. And it's what I could afford, you know? And my neighbor got mugged outside our building, like held at gunpoint. And my dad freaked out and he was like, I'm getting you an apartment in Santa Monica. And he went and he got this apartment on Ocean Drive. And it was like so beautiful. It was way nicer than where I lived. And he brought me there to look at it because he's like, this is crazy. I'm not going to let you prove a point by living in this dump. Like, you need to live somewhere safe. So I went and looked at it and I could see the ocean from the bedroom. And I was like, this is really nice. It would be much nicer to wake up here every day than like the dump that I'm living in. But I thought, if I do this, I will not be hungry enough to get out of this place.
It's like the Jerry Seinfeld of it all. Like the idea of you take the worst jobs mm-hmm. because you don't want to do them forever. Because if you're taking like a job that
you'll just get comfortable.
Yeah, exactly.
It's true. And I knew, I was like, I need to be in a place I don't like right now.
You need to be uncomfortable.
Because I haven't earned my way out of it yet. Mm-hmm. So I want to be in this shitty place that has no light and nasty bars in the windows and no parking and disgusting carpet in the hall. I need to do that for now. And so I said, no, I'm not moving into that apartment. And I stayed in the place that I was. And I stayed there until I could buy my way out of it and work my way out of it. And it honestly did help me. And I waited until we sold Barely Famous and had finished shooting season one until I moved out of it.
Wait, when you were working on the NBC Ryan Murphy show, were you still in that apartment?
Yes, you were.
So speaking of which, let's go back to your first professional TV writing job.
So my first job was on I did get lucky because when 3Arts wanted to sign me based on my Hello Giggles posts with a Single Girls Guide, I said, I don't know how to write a script. And so Ollie Obst, who's a manager there, who was brand new at the company, he said, I'll teach you how to write a script. And so we came up with a concept, something that was actually happening in my life at the time. And he said, send me 10 pages at a time and I'm going to help you. And he was like, this is not a joke. This is two jokes. And this is where an act break goes. And this is how you format dialogue. And I bought Final Cut. Final Draft. And I taught myself how to write on it, which is not that hard. It kind of does it for you. You kind of learn as you go along. So anyway, from that script that I wrote, luckily it got attention and I ended up signing at CAA. And then I got this job as a first year staff writer on an NBC show for Ryan Murphy called The New Normal.
What was that like?
You know, it was a really big learning experience. I could not believe that I had that job. I had been trying to work as an actress for 8 years, and I had never gotten a job that I felt was really, really exciting to me. It was always low-level shit that I didn't want to be doing. When I drove onto the Paramount lot every day, I thought that I was, like, driving into Kensington Palace.
You would call me and be like, this is crazy.
I just was so shocked because
You have your own fob at a studio. It's, like, the biggest deal.
I really felt like I'd made it. Yeah. And I really felt like I was getting paid to do something I never thought I would be good enough to get paid to do. You know, I never had a teacher in high school say, you're special, you're unique, your writing is important, your voice is special. I never had a thing other than my parents, like people who are biased, saying you're special and you're unique and you have a good voice and like not like a special voice. I never had an outside person take an interest in me. So I just assumed I wasn't good at anything. And Sarah and I were really close in age. And when it came to academics, Sarah got straight A's and I couldn't get through classes. When it came to sports, Sarah got on the all-star team and I was never picked to be on a team. When it came to socializing, Sarah had an easy time and I would just like trip everywhere I went. Like, I just didn't think that I could excel at anything. And so when I got paid to write on an NBC show, every time I drove on that lot, I was like, fuck, I was working at Free People a year ago thinking, I guess this is like what I'm meant to do.
Right, people like throwing clothes in your face, people that you knew.
Yeah, I really was proud of being there. And it ended up being a really challenging experience.
In what way?
I ended up having a really challenging time in the writer's room with my boss. And it was not a good fit. And I ended up getting fired. You know, I had someone, my boss, say to me, you're not a good writer. and you don't belong here. And it really, really scared me because I thought, fuck, that's my fear. That's what I've been thinking is the truth the whole time. And now someone's saying it to me. And so when that ended, I really had to decide what I believed. Do I believe that person or do I think they're wrong? And I decided that they were wrong. And I continued on and I ended up, I had had this idea with my managers at 3Arts for Barely Famous. And I went on and we sold our own show and wrote it and created it and produced it and starred in it and got it on the air. First time out of the gate. And it was really validating because I had this, you know, negative voice in my head of the only boss I'd ever had in a writing experience telling me I didn't belong there. And I didn't have an intention of like wanting to prove this person wrong. It was really more about proving myself
right.
Right. Yeah. It was more saying like, no, I think.
But when someone confirms your biggest fear, that's purgatory. I mean, that is like to escape out from that is.
Yeah. I was able
to. It's also kind of freeing in a weird way, though, too.
It was because I kind of was like.
You're like, that's just your opinion, man.
You have to be able to get there. Not everybody is evolved enough to be able to get there. And I commend you that you. I mean, for me, like, I don't know if I. That's
tough. It really became obvious to me that person's opinion really had nothing to do with me. It was a like, dynamic in a work environment, and
it's like road rage. Other yes, people's. It really, it's not about you.
I really was like, this has nothing to do with me. This is your thing. This is not my thing. And I'm going to continue forward because.
But good to have that epiphany.
It really did feel good. And it was a really defining moment. And I also think that no matter how negative the voice is in your head, and mine is loud, you always secretly have a voice in your head that's also there saying, that's not true. You're actually great. You know you're great. It's the same voice in your head when you go, fuck, am I ever going to get married and have kids? This is never going to happen for me. And then there's another voice that's like, also, you're completely fine. And I learned when I read, I feel it's so pretentious to say like books that you like read, but you know the book A New Earth?
Mm-hmm.
So I read that book a long time ago when I was like kind of struggling and lost and needing direction. And I remember him talking about how you have two voices in your head. You have like the id and the ego. And that whenever there's a voice in your head saying like, I'm crazy, I'm losing my mind, or I'm depressed, or like my life's falling apart, you always have a second voice that's observing that voice. That's like, you're going to be fine. You're not actually crazy. That's the voice of who you really are. And so I listened to the real voice. And the real voice knew that I actually was a good writer.
Can I just say, though, that I think being able to have the tools to shut out your ego is the most freeing, greatest moment of your life. Like, my ego ran my life in my 20s. Every decision I made, everything I thought about was all ego-driven. All of it. I mean, I even realized later, wait, I didn't actually love that person. That was total ego. I mean, your ego can play such evil, awful tricks on you. And I think the earlier on that you can find a way to quiet that voice, it's like the greatest thing you can do.
Yeah, well, it's the same. The ego is the voice that gives you false entitlement to things, and it's also the voice that gives you false negativity about yourself.
Talk to me about making Barely Famous. You said that was all green lights.
I had taken out another show. I had taken out a show and tried to sell a pitch right after working on The New Normal, and it didn't sell. And then I didn't know what to do. And, you know, Sarah and I's family has had a lot of reality TV from different family members, distant and close. And we never wanted to participate in it. So my managers at the time—
Why did you not want to participate in it?
It really just wasn't the path for us. We always felt like we were fighting this concept that we were entitled rich girls. And so we were hell-bent on proving that wrong by always working hard mm-hmm. and having real jobs and proving ourselves in another area.
I also just think the notion of like, I at least I know for me, I was still trying to be taken seriously as an actress. Like, in my mind, that was my focus. And now I think it's all sort of – it doesn't really matter.
It's more fluid now.
It's more fluid now. But then you can't be on a reality show if you're still trying to be taken seriously as an actress. Yeah. Like, that can't happen.
Our goals didn't align with what we would get from being in reality TV.
Totally.
So the point is that my managers called me and they said – you know, it's so funny. We get these phone calls every week from all these networks saying, when are we going to get the Foster Girls reality show? When are we going to get this like missing link in the center of all these reality shows? And they were like, it's never going to happen. You know, they're never going to do a reality show. And we all like looked at each other. We were like, is there something funny, like a satire show about two girls who like are surrounded by reality TV and they say they'll never shoot a reality show, but they film a reality show about that? Like, what if we were not ourselves? What if we were girls who like said that, but like couldn't really follow through with it? And we couldn't really figure out what the idea was at first because it was so like meta and inside an idea that we were like, what does it mean though? Like, what does it look like and what does it feel like? And there was something like, you know, when an idea just feels right and you just know you found something special.
Well, you keep coming back to it.
Yeah, you're like, this just makes sense. What if we just played these two really delusional girls who had no self-awareness and one of them thinks that she's so normal, but she's only normal in the context of her world. She's not actually normal. And another one who feels really entitled to being a famous actress and she doesn't understand why it's not happening for her. And that's where the idea was born out of. And I called Sarah when she was in Europe and I was, because Sarah and I had never worked together. Sarah had never been interested in doing like improv comedy or anything like that. So I really didn't know what her interest level was going to be. And I also had given up being in front of the camera. I was now just a writer. So the concept just came out of left field. And when I first pitched it to her, all she heard was like, reality. And she was like, no, 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 no. And I'm like, going, no, Sarah, it's a comedy. It's going to be making fun of reality.
I didn't get it.
And it was hard to get. Thank God for Curb Your Enthusiasm.
That's what I was going to say.
Because that's the best comparison. And I wrote out these scenes of Sarah wanting a bag that a celebrity then goes and gets, and me being on a date with a guy who's an Apple Store genius, which is like the scene I had written years before that I really wanted to bring back to the surface, and her thinking that she's normal and trying to be normal in front of this Apple Store genius who's actually normal and he thinks she's like super obnoxious and pretentious. And I had these handful of scenes, and I think when we started talking about it, then Sarah had ideas and then we started putting our heads together and it got her excited.
We all of a sudden sort of felt like, wait, we're like, what if this was like the Curb for females? But, you know, having an idea for a show, an idea means nothing. These networks, they get pitched like 50 shows a day. I mean, mm-hmm. That's all they just hear pitch after pitch after pitch. So from having an idea to writing out and developing a series, you know, you can't just walk in and be like, so you got to walk in, you got to tell them not only what the pilot looks like, but what the season finale looks like, who all the characters are, what their relationships are to each other. I mean, it's a long process.
Yeah. Did you workshop all of that before? Because I kind of feel like in some ways it's like a book deal for an unknown author. You almost have to send in the full manuscript because
very prepared.
The truth is, when we sold it to VH1, we took 5 pitch meetings. They were our first pitch meeting. They wanted to buy it in the room. And we were going, well, that was really easy. Like, they were ready to make a pilot with the exact pilot I had just pitched to them, which is very rare. And we thought, oh, that's really easy. Let's take the other meetings and see how the rest of them go. So we had a meeting with
FX.
FX that was
They loved the idea.
They liked the idea of a family that's ruined by filming a reality show. And they wanted it to be very dark and edgy. And we wanted it to be on FX. But we just didn't want to make the show they wanted to make. We wanted to make a show that was like a light comedy and a satire. We didn't really want to go like dark, hardcore, weird, and edgy.
We just wanted to make people laugh.
So that wasn't the right place for us. And we went to a couple other places.
CW
that wanted to change it or put it on their digital platform at the time.
And at the time, by the way, we were like, digital?
Yeah, you know, there was nothing digital happening.
Digital? Who watches digital?
So we ended up coming back around to that first pitch where VH1 bought it in the room, and they didn't want to change anything. They said, we'll give you this money. Go shoot exactly what you just pitched. And that's very hard to find.
They didn't give us notes.
We were just really excited to be able to go make the thing we wanted to make and be in control of it.
Were you nervous about, once you got that green light, about having that level of pressure and commitment and also freedom and responsibility?
You know, this is where Sarah and I have a fork in the road of how we felt starting the process, because I had had the experience at this point of being behind the scenes. So I had been writing on a show, and I had been writing scripts, and I had been – there's a lot more confidence being a writer than an actress. Being an actress is all built on insecurity. Everyone telling you your opinion doesn't matter. You can't make a move without asking someone what to do next. You're never in control. So Sarah hadn't been exposed to the other side of someone being like, what do you want us to do? Where do you want us to go? Like, you're in control. And I had had that. So I came in blazing, like – too much, being very confident, like, okay, I know exactly what I want to do. I know exactly what I want this to be. And I was like fearless about it. And Sarah came from a different angle of like,
right before day one going and shooting, the phone rang. It was Aaron's manager, Ollie, who became my manager, who I love deeply. And it was on speaker. And he was like, oh my, and a producer on Barely Famous. And he was like, I'm so excited. Are we ready? Day one is going to be amazing. I only have one concern, Sarah. And I did.
And I was like, you're on speaker. Sarah's right here. And it was not a great way to start.
And his defense, he was like, listen, you're like this actress that's been on a CW show for the last 4 years. Like, I just wanted to make sure that you were going to come in and be free of all that and really be in the moment and improv with these comedians. Because, you know, we completely infiltrated the show with comedians to make us look funnier. Mm-hmm. And he was like, look, I don't know if she's going to be able to go toe-to-toe with these people that we have brought in. And now I can look at it and go, like, I get that. As a producer on the show, I can totally, you know, Aaron had done a little stand-up stuff and Second City.
Yeah, I performed it at improv. And
exactly.
Like,
and
stuff,
I
so I had more experience
and,
there.
Yeah. So now looking back, I get it. But making that drive to day one where I was first up, the first scene was me, I was like, okay.
It was really scary.
I was like, oh, I'm going to suck, and I'm not going to be funny. Let's also remember, I'd never done really comedy before, you know, ever. So the stakes were really, really high. And if we failed, it was going to be all our fault because the show was our idea, our concept. We were the creators, the producers, starring, writing, casting. We cast it. We did locations. We did everything. So if it was going to fail, it was our fault.
So what was it like working together? Because this is the first time you'd really done that.
It was challenging.
For sure. I think it wasn't easy. And I think she felt like she had more of a power position because of her experience level. And then I was kind of like, yo, girl, we are 50-50 here and don't be doing that. But we really got to a point, I think, where I really appreciated her input. I always wanted her input. I would always defer to her. You know, we'd finish a take and I would ask for her to come in and give me notes. And then we even got to a point where Erin wanted my notes. She wanted me coming into the scene. So it took us a minute definitely to get there.
I had to work on my bedside manner because Sarah's my sister, right? So I would be like, she's not going anywhere. We're sisters. We're family. You can just be really honest with each other. I didn't take into account how insecure she was going to be going into this process, not knowing how well she could do. It turned out she's obviously great at improv and really funny, but she didn't know that yet. And so I would say, you know, you need to be like really unaware that she's going to make this joke. And then Sarah would do it, and I'd be like, no, stop. Sarah, I'm confused. Did you not just hear me? I just said you need to – and I'd be doing this in front of everyone. I'd be like, you're not listening to me. And it's because I'm talking to her like she's my sister.
Right now, if she were to just talk to an actress like that, that actress would call her agent and be like, I don't ever want to work with this woman ever again. But when you're family,
you just
– there are no boundaries. But here's the thing.
So we had to learn to have a good dynamic.
But at the end of the day, what we created together – is the thing that I think we're most proud of.
Sucks that it died so early, and it sucks that it wasn't at the right network and didn't have the platform that it deserved, because
Netflix wasn't around when we were pitching.
You know, I think if we had had a platform that made more sense for the content, it would have been a really big show.
Well, we were on a network that didn't program comedy. We were the first. They sort of wanted to change it up with us, and their audience wasn't really ready for it. But anyways, what it did is it propelled us to a completely different place in our career. All of a sudden, people were going, hey, they're show creators, they're producers, they're comedians. We started getting meetings with people we couldn't even fathom getting meetings with.
How did that lead to working with Bumble? What does it mean to be, you guys are heads of creative?
Yeah. Yes. So I don't know what the connection is to that other than to say that Barely Famous launched a sister brand between the two of us together that started, and you have take Instagram into account growing and us creating this sort of like comedic sister duo. And so then we started doing branded content together, and that launched more of like a digital platform for us. And so a year and a half ago, Bumble reached out kind of just through the proper channels of reaching out to representation saying, we want to have Aaron and Sarah come be on a panel with Whitney in
New
York.
Whitney Wolf, the founder.
Whitney didn't slide into your DMs.
She did not personally slide in. But I do think that she personally requested us and asked us to be on a panel with her. And that really was all we were asked to do. And we came on. And then when we did this panel together, we just had a great energy with the three of us, and we had a drink together after, and she just said, I really like the three of us together, and I want to come up with a way to do something bigger. We're launching Bumble Biz and Bumble BFF, and let's figure out a way for you guys to come on board in a much bigger way. So after months of negotiations and conversations, we came up with this concept of us being heads of creative, which it's a vague term that kind of means anything creative with the company, whether it be creating content, whether it be how to market the new branches of the business, promotions, marketing campaigns. Recently, they did this thing in New York, the Bumble 100. We helped a lot with that. We were a big part of the creative process.
We curated the Hive in LA.
Yeah, the Bumble there. Hive in LA. We became the access point out in the world for the tech company that was Bumble that wanted to sort of infiltrate where we had access.
Got it. And what do you love about working with Bumble, and what is challenging?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, people were surprised that we got that job. And I think we were surprised as well. And we had that moment of, oh, gosh, I really hope we can deliver because these are big shoes. This is a major company that's growing very rapidly. But I think deep down we knew that we could really be useful. And we had so many ideas, and it really excited us. And we sort of tapped into this a little bit earlier, but we're living in a different time now. We're living in a time where you can do so much more and not be pigeonholed. You can write a book, and you can host something, and you can start a clothing line, and you can be a chef, and you can go find this company, and it doesn't dilute your brand. It just enhances it. So the idea of us being able to be in business with a tech company with values that we so look up to and appreciate, it was sort of a dream come true.
They were very ahead of their time because Whitney, you know, her company, Bumble, was born out of circumstances leaving another company where she was not taken care of properly. And her reaction, the response to what happened to her with Tinder was, I want to create a female-run company that is a dating app that is a safe place for women where they feel heard, they feel taken care of, and they feel safe. And it happened right before this whole movement of empowering women, which, I mean, that movement started a long time ago, but the current movement. And we were really proud that it didn't take a Me Too movement to get Whitney Wolf and Bumble to realize that you need to listen to women and make them feel safe.
Yeah.
She was doing that already.
And Whitney is one of the first women that I have worked with who champions women the way she does. I've never seen it.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So does Hollywood still hold appeal for both of you?
Yeah,
I think the goal is—
Absolutely. It's always going to be like the seed of everything
else. Yeah, I think to get back on television, you know, we've sold a couple shows since Barely Famous. Erin just starred in a Fox pilot that she wrote with Don Johnson that I produced. It was a great experience. Yeah,
Daddy Issues?
Daddy
Issues, yeah, exactly.
I think the goal is always to be back on television, whether it be together or separate. I think we'll always be involved in what the other person is doing.
Yeah, we're always going to be producing if the other person's starring or whatever. And we've learned that we have a great partnership in many different forms.
It actually worked really well, Aaron starring and me producing. It was almost as good of a dynamic as Barely Famous, us acting together. I really discovered my producing skills, and
it also kind of flipped. It created this reverse situation that had happened on Barely Famous, because I started day one on the Fox pilot really nervous and really intimidated. I'd never starred in a network show by myself before. And day one, we were struggling, and you have every big Fox network there, and they're saying to me, we really need you to be less mad here. We really need you to be laughing and light about this. And I'm going, how can I be light about this?
You're finding out that my dad... I wrote this.
Yeah, I was like, I never said she was laughing here. But they kept like wanting something to be light. And it was a moment where I find out my dad's dating my best friend. And I'm like, I don't understand how you want this to be light. This doesn't make sense. Like, I'm pissed. The words are, how dare you? How do you make this light? And I was really sweating because I was like, I'm not going to deliver what they want. And then Sarah came in and she was like, okay, you need to say the lines as if you're like, you're laughing because it's so insane and it's so ridiculous that you actually can't believe it's happening. So instead of it like, how dare you? You're like, I mean, how dare you? This is insane. This is actually the craziest thing I could actually find out. It's like you're almost hysterical. And that made sense to me. And then I did it, and then everyone was like, oh, that's exactly what we wanted. And so if Sarah hadn't been that voice behind the camera to give that note to me, I don't know what I would have done.
Got it. So she was your advocate, too.
Yes.
That's very helpful to have. Okay, so last question. If you could take a time machine and go back in time and talk to younger Aaron and younger Sarah, say 21-year-old versions of yourself, what advice would you give yourself?
Well, I know mine.
Like I said before, my biggest regret is that I kind of checked out of school when I was such a good student. And it pains me all the time. And now having young daughters, I'm so scared to be in the same situation that maybe my parents were in. I really didn't live up to my academic potential. And that hurts. Like, that really hurts because I was unreal in school. I was so motivated. I was so focused. I got straight A's. I loved school. And at 16, 17 years old, I just pivoted. And I'm not proud of it. I was totally derailed. I got an older boyfriend. It was a dark time. So I think the advice is, when you're so young and you think that you have to grow up so fast, I think stay in your body and enjoy the age that you're in and know that life is long. You know, everyone says life is short, but life is long. And go to college, man.
I would say to my 21-year-old self to accept who you are and lean into your authentic, real self instead of trying to be somebody else. I was desperate to be anything but myself. I wanted to be edgier. I wanted to be smarter. I wanted to be more complicated. I wasn't the person that could ask a question because I was embarrassed if I didn't know the answer. I wanted everyone to think I knew everything. I picked boyfriends that made me feel bad about myself, that belittled me, that would, you know, make me feel stupid if I didn't use the word that I was using correctly. And I was just really terrified that who I was wasn't good enough. And I think that's a symptom of being young and insecure. And so I would really tell myself to just relax, take a deep breath, and accept who you are and learn to be good at it.
Perfect.
So inspiring.
All right. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you so much, Hillary.
I have a call. We got to go.
That was Sarah and Aaron Foster, heads of creative for Bumble. For more inspiring interviews with women like Sarah and Aaron, head on over to secondlifepod.com. If you like today's show, please, 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 please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or iTunes or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us and maybe say something nice about us. It makes a huge difference and we very much appreciate it. We love seeing you spread the word on social, and now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Twitter and Instagram. We always want to know who you'd like to hear from on this show. So send in your requests the old-fashioned way via email to hello@secondlifepod. Or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr. We are at Second Life Pod. The lines are always open. Feel free to just slide into our DMs. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.